The antidote to despair is action. It's completely understandable and, you know, logical in a way for people to feel overwhelmed, depressed, anxious, but frozen. Like, what can I do? Well, there's always something you can do. Absolutely always something you can do. And that's what gives you the energy to resist power, to resist injustice, you know?
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'll be with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. This week, we're chaining ourselves to the desk and not coming out till our demands are heard. Not literally, but we are going to hear all about the power of peaceful protest and the significance of standing up for what's right with Giz Watson. Giz has been on the front line of many movements, from the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations to nuclear disarmament at Grenham Common. She's also represented women in the male-dominated building sector, and somewhere in there too, she's worked on gay law reform. Yes, Giz was also in Parliament. It's Season 2, Episode 2 of Herstory with Giz Watson. This is Her Story.
My name is Giz Watson. I was born in a place called Eastleigh, which is in Hampshire in England.
Do you remember much about childhood? Are there any particular fond memories that stand out for you?
Yeah, I do. Came to Australia when I was 10, so I've got a reasonable recollection of growing up in England. We lived in a very beautiful part of the countryside, so for most of my growing up. And so we had a house that was situated in a small village, and, you know, there were the woods down the back, and there was the Hamble River, and myself and my brother had a lot of freedom just to go out and, you know, back in the days when kids could disappear all day, come back muddy and all the rest, as long as you got back by dark, nobody even asked where you'd been, really, so pretty good. And it's a real contrast, I think, to most kids growing up today, and I think it's a real shame because, you know, you learn a lot doing that kind of thing, and sometimes, you know, you encounter tricky things and have to sort them out. You know, I'm thinking of sort of environmental dangers like mud or, you know, tides, or in England you have bogs that you can actually, if you walk into them, you can actually disappear.
You lose a foot.
No.
You lose a whole body.
Yeah, potentially.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, it's, I mean, Australian bush is much more hazardous in a way, but there are elements of danger which you work out.
Was that sort of like, there's mythology now about Australia and that we have these giant human-eating spiders and that the bush, everything is just going to bloody kill you here. What was it like coming to Australia as a 10-year-old? Were people preparing you by telling you stuff like that?
Yeah, well, as a family, we decided we would prepare and read a lot, and we thought we'd better know a bit about where we're going. We weren't so focused on the dangerous beasties, although, you know, where we were living in Mandurah, when we did move to Australia in 67, there were certainly snakes. The surf was very dangerous. I think I nearly died in the first few weeks because I couldn't swim very well and, you know, not used to big surf, but also, you know, not being particularly afraid of trying things out. So, yeah, didn't really subscribe to the dangerous spiders and the all that, but they were there. You know?
Sure. I'm also from Mandurah. That's where
true.
I grew up. I imagine it's changed a bit between
just a bit.
You
67?
And
my... Yeah. It was a tiny little retirement village. Very quiet. You know, one of the things that my dad did was he thought it's a beautiful place to have a sailing club. No sailing club, just powerboats and fishing and whatever. And that was one of the things that he got into, and we built boats in the backyard. And
you know, he started the Mandurah Sailing Club?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, back in 67, 68. We imported flat pack mirrors and people made them in their backyards. And so they were good for young crew to learn to sail on.
Yeah.
So spent a lot of time sailing.
I remember having to learn how to do that in school, going down to the foreshore, and we learnt how to sail.
Yeah, good. Good, wow. Good. Well, he'd be very pleased if he was still alive. That's okay, Dad, I'll let you know.
His legacy lives on in the Mandurah foreshore.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's good. So there was, a small bunch of them, and he was very much the... you know, driving force. He's sailed all his life and couldn't believe that you had this beautiful estuary and access to the sea that wasn't being used for sailing. So we did it.
I have a feeling that that's going to be a running theme in this conversation. It's, we could see that you could do it, so we did.
We got on with it. Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's probably
that's fair to
a
say.
Theme. Yeah.
Tell me a bit more about your parents, Giz. When you moved here, what was the reason for coming to Western Australia, to Mandurah specifically?
To answer the first bit, last bit first, Mandurah was where Dad was offered a place in the medical practice there. So he came to a job in that practice, which he'd applied for and got from the UK. I think the primary reason in our family's mythology is that they were over the cold and wet weather. And we had one particularly miserable summer holiday where it rained solid for 2 weeks. And, you know, story goes, Mum and Dad said, well, we've got to do something else. They thought about going to Canada, but decided Australia was better and they had some connections through medical connections. Hence, they could Dad could line up a job. And look, I don't know how fussy he was, whether he was in Mandurah or whatever, but that was where the job was. And I have to say it was a beautiful place to start. Mm. It was a stunning little place back in the day before they wrecked it, sorry. In my view, I find Mandurah really disturbing because they've done so much to actually change the landform. And from what I have in my head, I go, what happened to that paddock that was there? Mm. It's now a canal. I just does my head in.
So Mandurah is maybe one of the first places, is it fair to say, for you where you really started to pay attention to the environment and the natural world around you?
Certainly getting used to the Australian environment and learning its beauties and its, you know, challenges and all the rest. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time on the Serpentine River down the back with kayaks and catching cobblers and
beautiful,
you know, dodging snakes and having bushfires. Not, we didn't like the bushfires, you know, dodging bushfires. Yeah, it was very adventurous. But also my folks bought a combi van, like in about 68, and every holiday we'd go out bush. So we camped a lot in the gold fields and down south. So
they're pretty keen to show you more of the land, hey?
And both adventurous and interested in the natural environment. Yeah.
That's something that you pursued later on in life. After high school, you were at Murdoch and you were studying their environmental sciences. Was that always the idea for you going into that tertiary phase?
Not always. I think what I found challenging is I was interested in lots of areas of study, I suppose. I was interested in everything from English literature to physics, you know, and so working out what was the logical tertiary education was tricky. I fancied I'd either be a professional sports person, do environmental science, or be a physio. Those are my three.
What sport?
Oh, I played quite a few. I played squash for the state, junior state. I played soccer, hockey. I sailed, tennis.
No netball.
You don't know the joke about what hockey players say about people who aren't playing very well.
Go
they
on.
Say, what are you, a netballer?
It's interesting because
I'm not the right height for a netballer.
We've spoken to women in the previous season of Herstory about growing up and they play sport, and a lot of them played netball.
Yeah.
And there's this mythology behind, depending on what position you play on the court, is it says a lot about your personality.
Oh, well, I can tell you what position I played in netball because we did have to play it.
Okay.
Have a guess.
Were you a GD?
No, I was the centre.
You were a centre, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Played the centre in every team, whether it was soccer or hockey or centre or halfback.
I feel like you...
Sorry, I lie. I'm sometimes in defence, yeah.
Yeah.
Fullback.
Yeah. Carmen Lawrence was a centre as well.
Yeah. I'm surprised. Yeah.
I feel like there's something
in that.
A parallel there somewhere. We don't have time today.
No, no, it's a position of directing play, I think is probably what...
Yeah, I'll pull up the junkie article and I'll send it to
yeah,
you.
Please yeah, please do.
So you're going to be a professional sports person or a physio or in environmental science.
Yes.
And that's just the way the ticket fell?
So I said to myself, if I get my first choice at uni, which was in environmental science, so that was the first time an environmental science course was offered in Australia at Murdoch in 75. And so I thought I'd like to be in on that. And I got it, so I did.
The first one ever in the entire country in 1975.
That's my recollection.
What was happening in the world of environmental... I'm just trying to understand why there wasn't one prior to that, or what was the catalyst to offer it only from the mid-70s?
Yeah, look, there might have been, and I'm happy to be corrected, there might have been some courses at other universities, but in terms of a school of environmental science, my understanding is that Murdoch set out on that in 75. That was their initiative.
Wow.
I mean, it was a very innovative university and pretty exciting. I mean, I think there were 30 students in that class, half of which were mature-age students.
Interesting.
So in terms of their shared life experience of environmental issues, that was really different to hanging out with high school kids. Yeah.
I imagine having lived in experience and coming to this class, and you're obviously fresh out of high school, a bit of like a world-opening or an eye-opening experience. I want to talk about the campaign to save native forests, because that's something that you were involved in as a student while studying at Murdoch. Is that your first active protest?
The second, probably. I was involved in anti-Vietnam demonstrations probably when I was... I've racked my brains up, probably 13, 14, that sort of age. I have an older brother who was very political. We used to hang out a lot together, so I would have gone along with him to those protests. I wasn't deeply involved in organising or anything, but I certainly was very vocal about the Vietnam War, made myself unpopular at school. School friends said, "Wait, why are you bothering about that?" Teachers didn't like it either. Yes, in terms of actively organising and being deeply participatory, that was the first thing. And
okay.
We'd had the woodchip bombing. I remember the first time I went up into the Jarrah Forest and I saw what was happening with the strip mining. I went, this is so wrong. And it's so ironic. Here I am at the age of 65 still fighting the same battle.
From 13 years old, your first act of protest or first involvement in a protest, that seems quite young. I mean, maybe by today's standards, we see people and the reach of protest is far more instantaneous and far easier and more accessible globally. But at 13, and you mentioned they're not being popular with teachers and students alike, what motivated you to keep doing that? Was that being guided by your older brother?
Partly, but also certainly my mother and to a maybe slightly lesser extent my father were fully supportive. And I know my mother was very influenced and concerned about the Vietnam War. So we got full encouragement to get involved. And I don't remember ever being criticised or questioned for getting involved in political issues. It's funny because I always thought my parents were quite conservative, but it's only when you realise later they're probably quite radical. So unlike a lot of younger folk, I had full, you know, approval of my parents. There weren't parents who worried about you, like where you were or whether you were going to, you know.
But you were covered in mud. You were fine.
That's right.
That was the worst of it.
I think they always knew that I could look after myself, which, yeah, was something I think was probably reasonably accurate.
So talk to me about when you're at university and you're part of the campaign to save native forests. Is that when you first become more involved in the organisational side?
Yeah, so I joined the campaign to save native forests, which was the main group working on the Jarrah Forest. And there was a bunch of us that decided we'd run out of options in terms of legal options to prevent the expansion of the bauxite mining. So we deliberately decided we were going to do civil disobedience in the same spirit as it was being conducted in the States against nuclear reactors and, of course, within protests around the Vietnam War. So we studied and worked for 6 months and then we went down and said we were going to sit in front of the bulldozers. It predated Tasmanian Franklin Dam and there was a core, there was really only probably about 20 of us who thought this is the only option we're left with. And there's a very fine tradition of civil disobedience which we can build on.
That must have been one of the first major examples within the Western Australian landscape of that kind of civil disobedience, though.
Yeah, look, I'm not totally across all of the history. I mean, I'm sure... If you look at First Nations protests, I think Noongar predated. I'm not
sure.
Quite sure. I wouldn't want to claim we were the first ones to do it. I think we were the first to decide that we'd kind of do it by the book. We actually got some Quakers to come over and teach us. I'm not saying that others didn't look for support and advice, but look, it was early days. It was the days of Sir Charles Court, who was Premier, and there were some very draconian laws, including the one that we were charged with, which was obstructing or conspiring to obstruct a government-ratified project. That's across the board. That's like as broad as that.
Okay.
And it was in the day also when there was a law that said a gathering of three or more people in a public place is illegal.
It sounds like...
And that was an anti-union law.
Right. That just sounds ludicrous.
It was a lot of power in the state, yeah, there was. And that's kind of really ultimately what they threw at us, because they, after we were successful in our first action and the court basically threw out the charges, then the parliament simply upped the penalties to the point that most people couldn't risk, you know, the fines or the imprisonment.
How old were you at this stage?
I think I was probably 18.
Yeah. Were you nervous or scared at any point?
No, not at all. I mean, no, I don't think I was, because I was with a bunch of good mates who I trusted, and we'd done a lot of work together, so we felt trusting and safe with each other. I thought it was important, and I didn't mind if I was going to go to jail or whatever. I didn't really, you know, it was urgent. This needed attention, and it really did have a profound impact on politics in the state. Only just recently we put together an exhibition of the whole history of forest campaigns in the state, and very interesting to revisit some of that material and some of the press of the day. It certainly threw up some big questions.
How do you feel now when we see groups like Nanas for Native Forests, and we see School Strike for Climate, and people still now going into places like the Tarkine and chaining themselves to trees or sitting in front of bulldozers? How do you feel seeing what you were doing all those decades ago still in a relatively similar space now?
On the one hand, I feel incredibly frustrated that it takes so long. I mean, one of the things that I'm deeply involved in at the moment is the WA Forest Alliance, and I'm part of that core team. So we are still in the thick of sorting out, looking after the forest, managing the forests for biodiversity and to protect them as much as we can against climate change. Part of me goes, I love this stuff and I love the people we work with, and I love the courage and inventiveness of direct action and civil disobedience, and all the politics and the advocacy and all the other things that happen around that. It's not just about sitting in a tree, it's about winning hearts and minds. And I think we are making progress, but it's frustratingly and dangerously slow.
Yeah. I think that's very fair to say. I want to come back a little bit more to Western Australia and your involvement in the environment and what ultimately leads to politics in a moment. But let's pull it back. 1980s, you moved back to the UK. Tell us about what was going on at that time in your life. What were you doing? Were you finished uni at that point? What led to that move?
Yes, I just finished uni, and my partner was very keen to go and visit England and Europe. So I said, okay, let's go. Part of it was the classic ritual of going to Europe and England and seeing what's there. I was very involved with environmental issues here. And then when I got to London, I sought out forest conservation organisations there, and I found them culturally very alien to me. So I got more drawn into the feminist anti-nuke, anti-war movement, and I happened to go to a meeting of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament just at the point where they made a decision to train all their local groups in direct action. So I thought, well, I know a bit about that. I've done some training and I could learn something as well. So I got myself into what was a relatively small group of trainers. And so over the next 2 years, we trained every local group around the country in direct action, either against reactors or, at that stage, there were US missile bases right around the UK.
Was this like a covert option? I'm imagining these secret meetings happening under pubs in the dead of the night.
Ooh, some of them were. Was it covert? No, not explicitly. If you were organising for a specific action, yes, one had to be much more mindful of keeping certain information to yourself. I mean, I was involved in London in actions where we obviously had been infiltrated, and it was a high level of risk. You've got to think of London in the early 80s. The IRA were active, and the police were always going to assume if there was something happening that it was going to be the IRA before they'd think it was anybody else. That meant, you know, it was dangerous. Literally was dangerous. No, the peace group training, we had a lot of fun, you know. We really did. It was exhausting, but we had a lot of fun. And meant that there were local groups who were skilled and confident about taking it up to, you know, construction of the next nuclear reactor, or, as is famously known, Greenham Common.
Give us a bit of a history lesson on Greenham Common. What is that? Where is that? What were you preparing for?
So Greenham Common is a military base which was run by the US. I think it was a joint facility, but it was a large base that had cruise missiles. Now, cruise missiles are intercontinental ballistic missiles that carry nuclear warheads. Nasty pieces of work. So the debate, or the kind of pointy end of what was happening with nuclear weapons in Europe, was if there was a exchange, if there was an accident, if someone pushed the button, you had 20 minutes if you lived in the south of England. Yeah, and that's rather sobering. And that was very much part of the messaging to engage the public debate. So particularly women got very active in deciding that we needed to get those weapons out of the country. And Greenham is about an hour and a half south of London, a town called Reading, and that became the target, primary target. It was the first of the bases to be protested at. But it also became a camp, and it was a camp, famously, that was run by women and exclusively. There was a gate to the camp, which was the mixed camp, so it wasn't exclusively women only. But the dynamic of that, and the solidarity, and the radicalising, particularly of middle-class women, you know, was profound. And I attended actions and trained women to go to Greenham. I never stayed there for any length of time. But full credit to the women who stuck that out right through winter and snow and the whole bit, where the police would come and bust up those tents, throw them out in the middle of the night. It wasn't easy. It wasn't pretty at all. It was really a big challenge to keep that going. But then you have examples where we had an encirclement of the base. 8 miles of people arm in arm all the way around. You know, the mobilisation of numbers was profound.
The mobilisation of numbers, but you mentioned that the mobilisation of everyday women, women that you were coming across and training. What were you thinking at the time when you are in a room in your covert underground London pub training sessions?
You like that image, don't you?
I do. I see you like in
that I do know about some underground pubs.
But it's a different podcast.
Yeah, okay. London After Dark.
Yeah. Oh, we're fraught with danger. Tell me about some of these women that you're coming across and meeting. Were they all just in the same mindset of something needs to be done about this? Or what was it that was pushing women particularly to act?
Well, look, it was a combination of things. There were some really good publications, that feminist publications, that were telling exactly that thing, you know, 20 minutes, if you have a nuclear exchange, you know, these things. I mean, most people didn't know they were there. I mean, this is the way that the military operate, and certainly in England. It was a real eye-opener for me, because not only was I with the CND, I was with groups called Women Oppose the Nuclear Threat. So they were kind of like little cells, and they were all around London and in Manchester and Birmingham and Bristol. And they were the nucleus that did the talking and had drew in more women to be informed and to take action. Greenham Common started, interestingly, because there was, I think, only a handful of women walking from Wales. They walked to Greenham to protest about the base. And when they got there, they thought, well, we can't go home now. Now, some of those women, this is going to give me goosebumps, stayed for 15 years.
Wow.
15 years. And I had a little cutting on my board in my parliamentary office, which said the fence is coming down at Greenham Common. I mean, honestly, it just made me weep. These things do not happen overnight, but you have to be determined to just keep going at it, keep going. And they did. And you know, it's extraordinary. The whole might of the American military, you know, something that's central to their supposed strategic deterrence.
And some women in the UK said,
no, not a good idea. No, we don't like that. So there were growing sort of grassroots discussions, and there were huge rallies as well. There's no question we had some massive rallies in London. But it was a grassroots awareness-raising exercise.
Giz, for people who can't quite wrap their head around the concept of protest, if they think, oh, this is just obstructive and it's scary, why would you want to put yourself in danger of being in front of the police or something like that? They can't quite grasp the concept of why people protest. What would you say to them, or how would you explain it to them?
Gosh, that's a challenge, isn't it? Because I'm so steeped in it. Perhaps to use a more contemporary example, the Nanas for Native Forests, who you mentioned, are an example, again, of women who, you know, their first instinct isn't to go and, you know, sit in front of a bulldozer or get up at, you know, 2 a.m. and go and put yourself next to a bunch of logs. But when people think about it and read about it and talk about it and realise, and actually, I think, directly, viscerally experience the environmental destruction that's going on, something shifts. And so there is a bravery that comes out of that, because the movement is very much about looking after each other as well. It's the issue, but it's actually how we get there. Not only do they feel pretty confident about doing it, but they also will stick at it. I'm sure that a lot of those senior women have never been to a protest before. I've got a quick segue. So there's a beautiful little video, YouTube video, which I saw filmed in a coal mine in Wales. So there's a senior woman who's doing some direct action. She's dressed as a polar bear, and she's sitting in the middle of this coal mine with a U-bolt, you know, one of those U-locks around her neck, in freezing cold, and saying how much she's enjoying the fact that she's, you know, at last taking some action to protest about fossil fuels. It's beautiful. And she said, somebody even made me breakfast. It's like... Now, I'm not suggesting that all protests are calm and benign and people, you know, are always happy and don't get hurt, because all of that happens as well. But there's something really, really solidifying or kind of empowering to take action. I think empowerment. So there's an amazing activist called Joanna Macy, who people, hopefully some of your listeners may know, because she's an extraordinary author and activist, peace activist, a Buddhist, and direct action trainer. And she's been to WA numerous times. And I was very influenced by the book that she wrote in the 80s, which I think was called Despair and Empowerment in the Nuclear Age, because the antidote to despair is action. It's completely understandable and, you know, logical in a way for people to feel overwhelmed, depressed, anxious, but frozen. Like, what can I do? Well, there's always something you can do. Absolutely always something you can do. And that's what gives you the energy to resist power, to resist injustice, you know?
It's like roll the credits here.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll go home.
Get me going on this one. But it's a lived experience, how you can shift. And I've seen people, some of the most arguably apparently timid, apparently anxious, apparently, you know, disempowered, get into this stuff and go, wow, okay,
let's get
bring
to
it on, let's do it. There are some fundamental truths, and unless you stand up for them and really say, this is so important that I'm going to take some risk. I mean, I know I didn't care less about what job I might have or whatever. That's unusual because a lot of people go, well, there's all these other considerations in my life and that's why I can't do it. Well, you might not be able to do that bit, but there's a lot of other bits that you can do. Any of these civil disobedience campaigns have an underlying strength of supporters and people who are activists but maybe aren't going to be the ones that are sitting on the front line.
Well, there's a network of people. I mean, you quite literally were. You were the trainer for those people in direct action. I want to talk a bit about post-Grenham. Where did you leave off? Because you came back to Australia mid-1980s.
Yeah, my mum came and got me.
She pulled you out of the mud.
Sort of. No, she probably wouldn't want to have distracted me from that task, being a good pacifist herself. She said, we would like you to build a house for us, and will you come back to Australia and build a house? Yeah, look, I think the political work had been very intense. Well, that's just, you know, one of the bits of the work I was doing there, had been very intense. So I quite liked the idea of being back in a slightly quieter life, and not that building a house is particularly quiet. Meanwhile, while I'd been in the UK, I'd got a trade certificate, City and Guilds in London, and so I had a trade certificate in carpentry and joinery. And I came back to Australia and also then enrolled to be a registered builder.
I found it really interesting. By 1992, you were one of three female builders in Western Australia. I had to double take and reread that because it seemed kind of, well, silly, to be honest. Only three women?
Yeah, and I think both of them had come up through architecture rather than from a trade. I could be wrong, and I hope there are more women builders these days. At that time, I was thinking, well, one, I need to have, well, I just take one step back. The reason that I trained as a carpenter and joiner is that after I'd finished my environmental science degree, I didn't want to work for a mining company, didn't want to work for the government, and there really wasn't many other options. So I thought, well, I need a trade or a qualification that is portable. So that's why I started down that track, and I'd already done some building work, and I enjoyed it and was reasonably good at it. So that was my logic. And then I thought, well, if I come back to Australia, I would like to set up the possibility of having an all-women's building collective, mm-hmm. or I'd worked in a building collective in London. So
Anarchist Building Group.
That's right.
Which collective, is a great name.
Yeah, yeah. What was a collective something and design? Run along anarchist principles. Everyone was paid the same. We made all our decisions by consensus, and we subsidised a whole lot of sort of public work type projects, building centres for people with disability and that kind of stuff.
Wow.
We made our cash on the private market, and then, you know, a reasonable price for community projects. So it was great. It was a great bunch to work with.
Yeah.
And I was inspired by that. And at that point in time, I thought, well, we need something like that in Australia.
So I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah. Someone's got to start.
I told you this would be a running theme
in this conversation.
Yeah. You said you didn't want to work for the government. Ultimately, though, you have ended up in some way in politics. Tell me about when you first were interested or maybe first got involved with the West Australian political system.
Yeah, so, I mean, to be clear, there's often an assumption that if you've been in Parliament, you've been in government. I have never been in government or worked for a government department. So I was busy building houses and living on the south coast, just out of Albany, and I was involved in the local peace group. I think I might have been the secretary, and my mum was as well. We used to protest the nuclear warships that at that stage were docking in Fremantle and Albany and I think probably Geraldton as well. So we were, wasn't a huge group, but we were adamant that we make them feel unwelcome when they arrived or acknowledge them they weren't as welcome as everybody thought they were. Not the sailors, the ships. I had a phone call in probably January 1990 to say, oh, we've formed a political party and we're looking for candidates. Would you be interested? They were asking a lot of people. And nobody wanted to do it. It sounded like too much work, or because there was an election, I think either February or March, like right in a month's time. We'd like somebody to run for the Greens in the seat of Forrest, which is the southwest. And, you know, out of somewhere out of left field, this voice said, oh, yeah, I could do that. I thought, oh, did I just say that? Gosh. So literally that's how it happened. We had 10 people on the phone. No, couldn't do it. Nobody in Bunbury, nobody in, you know, wherever it was, probably Mandurah. And so I said yes. And then, of course, I had to join the party. And not that I just hadn't thought about it before. But when I read the policies and I read the constitution and I thought, at last there's a political party that reflects the values and the objectives that I have. I mean, obviously I knew about the Greens. I knew about the Greens in Germany. I knew about, particularly in Europe, the rise of the Greens. But I hadn't really had time to contemplate joining a political party and didn't mind joining a political party and had an absolute hoot. You know, being a first-time candidate.
What were the 1990s Greens like in WA?
Oh, well, look, there's an interesting bit of, you know, history to the establishment of the Greens Party here in WA. There were parallel movements that had been evolving since probably, certainly through the 80s, maybe a bit earlier. And my friend Louise Duxbury ran in 1987, for a group called Green Development that was based in the southwest. So they were forming a political party. I think there were plenty of people who had heard from Labor people, oh, well, you know, you haven't got any choice. We're better than the other mob. You know, you've got to vote for us. And that was caused certainly my partners to be absolutely incensed. And so people turned around and said, oh, I better form one. That's not good enough. And you've got to remember, this is the point where the ALP had reneged on uranium mining, which was a huge blow for all of us in the environmental movement, despite other good things that they had done. That was a real deal breaker. So not surprisingly, some of the key players in organising here in WA were people like Joe Valentine, who was an anti-nuclear activist with the Nuclear Disarmament Party. She'd split with them. The Valentine Peace Party was one of the others that came in. So, yeah, look, there were some really energetic and feisty people who were keen to set up a political party, and there were some fairly intense negotiations to have that happen just ahead of that election, federal election in 1990. I didn't have anything to do with those conversations, but it was a relatively small group.
So when were you first a part of the parliament then? Were you successful in your first election?
Oh, no, not at all. No. This is you have to play a long game most of the time. I ran, I think, 6 times before I was elected. I got elected in December 96 and took up my seat in May 97. The upper house has got fixed terms, had then and still does. Yes, so by that time I was in the metro and ran for a couple of the seats in the North Metro area, Cottesloe and Curtin. In 96 I ran for North Metro and got in, much to my surprise. Well, I knew it was possible, but yeah, it was still pretty close.
When you finally find out that you've been elected, are you like, ah, shit, now I've got to do the thing?
Well, something like that. That's probably exactly the sort of language I was going to be using. I certainly went, oh, gosh, I don't know the first thing about Parliament and how it works. Only time I've been to Parliament is to protest on the steps. So I'm familiar with the security. So that was a bit of a shock to the system. And I was very fortunate to have an excellent electorate officer who had a lot of experience and was able to assist me in that process. I felt I could talk about the policies, I could facilitate meetings, all those kind of things. But what I didn't know is how does Parliament itself work? How does legislation get written? You know, what are all these committees? What do they do?
What's with the chimes?
What's with the chimes? Ding dong. Yeah, those damn bells. Exactly. Hot-footing it to the chamber before they shut the door.
What were you heading into Parliament for? What was your agenda?
Yeah, good question. Well, we had a set of policies that we would have been highlighting for that particular election. There was no shortage of policy areas that needed work. Gay law reform was one. Gay men were still criminalised in the state in 96. There was the uranium mining issue I've always been passionate about. Environmental matters, whether that was bauxite or other impacts. Abortion was an issue. It was still criminalised. The list went on, really. I was spoilt for choice. some MPs go in with a specific objective. Sheryl Davenport is someone comes to mind, who I really enjoyed working with on the abortion law reform. I could say Diana Warnock in a similar vein. Not that they weren't worried about other things, but they had a, you know, specific thing. So in that first term, we were in the balance of power with the Democrats. So ourselves, the Democrats and the Labor Party, had the numbers in the upper house. First time that's happened in WA's European history, 103 years or 106 years. So it was a big shake-up for the system, for the Conservatives, not to have control of that house.
Mm.
We could do some things, but the Libs were still in power. Wasn't until the next election when we could really get rolling.
They didn't have the tendency just to be able to ram things through, though, because you were in the upper house.
Well, you can introduce new legislation or amendments to legislation in the upper house, but you still got to get it through the lower house. So if the numbers are in the lower house are with the Libs and Nationals, then they were going to slow things up or, you know, vote them down. And I have to say, there are many occasions where the block on progressive legislation was the Labor Party. In this instance, though, we were working cooperatively together on most things.
You mentioned there, Giz, about gay law reform as one of the many things that you were able to bring in and talk about policy on. It's been reported a lot. I'm not sure how you feel about the tagline of you were the first openly lesbian woman in Parliament in any part of the country.
Yeah, happy with that. Yeah, no, that's
happy
right.
With that.
And, well, it was interesting because just after it was announced that I'd been elected, one of the journalists from the Sunday Times somehow got wind that I was a lesbian, and she ran this article that somehow I'd lied to the voters. I'd misled them that I had this sort of covert agenda and I was now in Parliament and I was going to be carrying it out. And I went, well, hang on a sec. I've said all along, you know, I've got a partner, June, and, you know, figure it out. And it was a bit of a moment where I thought, oh, if this is going to get nasty, this is where it will. And look, I had one nasty letter from some random person. That was it. Moving on.
So it wasn't even a conscious decision necessarily to go, I'm the gay parliamentarian. It was just...
No, that's right. And I just went, yeah. June and I discussed it. Do I run out and say, well, you know, I'm announcing to the entire world that I'm lesbian and, you know, I'm going to run for parliament? I thought, no, but we're also not saying no, and you don't have to look very far to figure this out. So I think that was a reasonable line because, as I've said, I think probably in the Parliament and elsewhere, I also don't want to be known as that's my own only attribute because, you know, heterosexual people don't have to do that.
I'm the straight environmental parliamentarian.
Exactly. By the same token, I'm very aware in terms of providing solidarity and, I guess, my leadership to people in the GLBTI community, it's really important that they do know that there's someone there who has lived experience and knows what it's like. And, you know, some of the challenges to try and have particularly issues around school kids and discrimination and prejudice addressed were really hard.
Being openly queer in Parliament is one thing. I imagine some people would have thought your background was quite radical in activism. Mm. Was there a place for that in Parliament at the time?
I think the challenge as activists and Greens are usually not exclusively have MPs who have an activist background. Obviously, there are others from the left who come from union activists or other areas, is working out what's possible. And it's very interesting because it's very topical at the moment, of course, with people like Lydia Thorpe, Senator Lydia Thorpe, clearly an activist with the grassroots, experiencing day-to-day lived trauma in her networks, how you interact and work within a very conservative, it is inevitably a conservative place, is a constant assessment, reassessment. I mean, I think probably for my experience, a little bit of sort of long game playing, a little bit of patience with one's opponent. I strongly feel that adhere to the principle of respecting your opponents, even the real bastards, sorry. You know, there is a way of doing that where you don't have to say you like them, you don't have to say you agree with them, but you pick your moments. And that's how I've operated in the Parliament, and I think that's one of the reasons that I've been relatively able to achieve certain things. I'm not judging anybody else. You can't have... Parliament's meant to represent the people, but it's also got to function. You know, you can chip away to change things and, you know, challenge rules that are archaic. There are obviously things like family-friendly hours for Parliament. All of those things, yes. And there is a role to change them from within, but there's also a role to keep the pressure on from outside. Hopefully one can do both at different times.
If you could do them during the same time, it'd be very impressive.
Well, you sort of can. I mean, some of my colleagues were a bit into doing stunts, which one of my dear colleagues tabled. You know, table means you bring something into the parliament and you actually put it on the table, a stuffed chudich. Now, you know, that was okay, but nobody'd ever done that before, and it was making a point about endangered species. And a little bit of that is fun and it's good. Probably don't want to be doing it every day.
It's a shame that some of the best tabled protests come from interesting parts of Parliament in the federal sort of space. I think of...
The lump of coal?
I think of the lump of coal. I think of Bob Catter dressing up as the Grim Reaper to mourn the end of the car manufacturing industry.
Oh, my God, I didn't even see that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. These sort of stunts aren't exclusively ours, no.
No, they come from everywhere. It takes all types.
Let me tell you a funny story, if I've got a moment. When we were doing the gay law reform and it was being debated, and it took a while to go through both houses of Parliament, there was a decision that we'd have a day when the members who were supporting the changes would wear pink suits, pink shirts, whatever you like, really. And so we all rock up with a pink something. And one of the Conservatives over the other side of the chamber happened that day to be wearing a pink, I think they call them twin sets. And she was looking around the chambers across at people on our side, or, you know, all these blokes in pink suits. And eventually she came out and said, "Why is everybody wearing pink today?" And so I said, "Well, you know, there's this decision that, you know, this, it's in solidarity." And she went white as a sheet. And she said, "Oh, no, I just happened to wear pink today." Anyway, felt so strongly about it that at the end of the day she felt she had to put on the record that she just by happenstance chose a pink twin set. It was the most hysterical I thought, "You're just making it worse. Most people probably wouldn't have even noticed." But anyway, it was hysterically funny, and she was so awkward about it. "Oh, no, you're making this worse."
Someone's going to listen to this and go back into the archives now to figure out who that was.
Oh, yeah, I can tell you who it was. It was Robin McSweeney. It wasn't, you know, she's not a bad person, just reasonably conservative.
On Wednesdays we wear pink. Yeah. I don't know what else to tell you. Yeah. You clearly got the newsletter.
I mean, in a way, it's funny all round. Serious but funny, but I'm sure she probably wouldn't even mind being named.
Enough years have gone by now.
Enough years.
And really, if she wasn't on board then, the last few years haven't been kind.
No, and she might like, you know, everybody to be reminded that she wasn't actually in solidarity. She just happened to be wearing a pink twin set on the day.
That's wonderful. You're no longer sitting in Parliament, although politics is still a pretty big part of your life. What are you doing to keep busy these days?
So I've got two main projects. I'm at the moment writing an evaluation of the recent federal election where we Greens have done exceptionally well. It's very exciting to have increased numbers in the Parliament and all the opportunities that come with that. I'm enjoying writing that, and I suppose a bit as a party elder, you get asked to help with mentoring and training and advice, so I continue to do that. I'm also very active with the WA Forest Alliance secretary and working behind the scenes, particularly supporting and mentoring younger women to be active in the environment movement and to be leaders in the environment movement. Third one is with an organisation called the Women in Environmental Leadership, which I was in on the ground floor with that, encouraging training and mentoring young women to do feminist politics in the environmental movement. And that's great.
Work cut out for you.
As I said, there was a job. I can find one there. They don't, you know, necessarily pay, but there's plenty. You know, look, we're at a really pivotal moment with climate action. I wake up every morning and think, what is the most effective thing I can do to prevent runaway climate change? go to bed thinking that, wake up thinking that, and it's where one can put one's skill, knowledge and resources to achieve that. Because if not, we're absolutely stuffed, to be brutally frank. I spend a lot of time in the country, down in the southwest, and you can see what's happening. It's horrible. It's really heartbreaking. And I'm very committed to ecological restoration, big scale, landscape scale. And so we're working also with GondwanaLink, which is an excellent project. Google it if you haven't already. Get behind that. We need to have a robust environment that will survive what's coming.
In amongst the many triumphs and accolades and things that you have done in your life, one of them is being inducted not just into the Women's Hall of Fame here in WA, but during its inaugural year. Can you talk to us about the significance of highlighting women and their achievements and all of the things that they've done as individuals, but also as a collective to better the world?
Yeah, absolutely. What is the adage? You can't be what you can't see. So I think it's really powerful to highlight and celebrate women of influence and to recognise that in WA we've got a range of extraordinary women who've really are leading in various ways, whether that's, someone like Betty Rishbith, who was an early environmentalist, or someone like Jo Valentine, who's worked tirelessly for peace and disarmament. I think we've got a wonderful selection of inspiring women in the state. And obviously I have a passion for women who uphold feminist values and recognise that women need to do things differently, organise differently, work together collectively. That's what I would like to see us, celebrate and reinforce with celebrating some of those fantastic women.
Giz Watson, thank you very much for being part of Herstory.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thanks to Giz Watson and all the women at the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minasale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition by Annika Moses. Artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. This podcast was produced on Whadjuk Noongarrbuja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respect to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. My name's Taylor Strano, and next week we'll hear from the woman who started TEDxUWA.